via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a discussion with author of the book Failure to Protect. Barry Smoot will be here talking about recent proposed changes to the Choate Developmental Center in Anna, Illinois, and that's due to revealed abuses and crimes against residents with intellectual disabilities in recent months. But first, disability news for the week of March 13th, 2023. The directors of psychiatry residency programs across the country have reported that students receive just a few hours per year of training in autism and intellectual disability and have limited exposure to patients with those conditions. The journal Autism recently published the report based on surveys of administrators at more than 80 accredited psychiatry training programs in 2019. 46 of the programs focused on child and adolescent psychiatry, 33 for general psychiatry residents, and 2 pediatric programs. Almost half of child and adolescent psychiatry programs reported that trainees received only 4 to 6 lecture hours per year on autism. About a third said residents saw 11 to 20 outpatients on the spectrum per year and a similar number of inpatients with the conditions, while trainees in most remaining programs saw fewer than that. It was learned that residents in general psychiatry programs had even less experience with people with disabilities. A similar study from 2009 revealed that many psychiatry residents at that time received as few as 3 to 4 lecture hours per year and saw only 1 to 5 patients in clinical settings annually. The authors of the latest study note that limited knowledge of autism and intellectual disability has consequences, leading psychiatrists to be over-reliant on medication and restraint rather than using therapies. President Biden's budget proposal was released on Thursday. The draft serves essentially as a wish list detailing how the president would like to allocate money for the new fiscal year beginning in October. But Congress will determine the final plan. Biden is seeking $16.8 billion in spending on special education services for students with disabilities, which amounts to a $2.1 billion increase in pre-K through high school. He also wants an additional $392 million for early intervention for infants and toddlers and an additional $150 million to recruit and retain special educators. The budget proposal continues another push to invest in Medicaid home and community-based services in the amount of $150 billion over the next 10 years. Also, a part of Biden's plan is to create a national program providing paid family and medical leave for workers for up to 12 weeks. Advocates say such a move would be very helpful to families of those with developmental disabilities. The budget also includes additional money to improve customer service at the Social Security Administration, provide housing to more people with disabilities, and improve accessibility at national parks. Finally, last week, Secretary Grace Howe of the Illinois Department of Human Services explained a, quote, repurposing and restructuring of Choate Developmental Center in Anna that will start with relocating 123 residents with developmental disabilities who entered the facility voluntarily, about half of the current population. Governor Pritzker said that the department has been working on improvements at Choate since he first took office, but that, quote, there were more significant changes that needed to be made, end quote. The announcement was described by the governor's office as a transformational behavioral health initiative, which comes after months of reporting by Molly Parker of Capital News Illinois and Beth Hunsdorfer of ProPublica that revealed information about patients being beaten, cover-ups by staff, intimidation of employees into staying silent about that. The reporters revealed that local prosecutors have filed felony charges against at least 49 people, both residents and employees, since 2015. IDHS has committed to helping residents move from Shote within the next 2 to 3 years, Howe said. She said some will move into other state-supported centers and others will go to community settings. IDHS will also develop a plan for additional 112 residents with developmental disabilities who currently live in specialty units, including people who were sent to Shote by judges who found them unfit to stand trial or not guilty by reason of insanity. Howe said that the state is likely to move a significant portion of those residents, but that they don't want to rush the decision before determining the capacity needed to serve them. The state of Illinois has not described their plans for Shote as a closure, and no layoffs were announced. Shote Psychiatric Hospital will stay open and may even expand, according to Howe, saying that they will work with the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine to determine the best path forward. Howe said this restructuring is part of a goal to expand services for people with developmental disabilities in Illinois who are receiving state funding and want to live in the community. Ultimately, the objective is to cut the number of people living at its 7 developmental centers. Illinois has been criticized for decades by advocates and legal organizations for its reliance on large public and private residential institutions for people with disabilities and for its lack of adequate funding for community-based options. In the last 50 years across the country, states have reduced the number of people with developmental disabilities in state-operated institutions by more than 90%. As of 2018, only 4 states, Texas, North Carolina, New Jersey, and of course Illinois, each had 1,000 people or more with intellectual disabilities in those settings. Closures of large institutions happened more quickly following the 1999 Olmstead decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which found it unconstitutional to segregate people with disabilities from the rest of society. 17 states across the country no longer operate developmental centers at all, and others have dramatically reduced the number of beds they operate. And that's the news for this week.
Closing time, open all the doors and let you out into the world. Closing time, turn all of the lights on over every boy and every girl. Closing time, one last call for alcohol.
So and you are tuned to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I am joined today by my most frequently returning guest in recent months, Barry Smoot, who is the author of the book Failure to Protect. I must disclose from the very beginning, though, Barry, and you know this too, you and I don't agree on everything, but we certainly agree on enough that we can keep this conversation going for a while. So why don't we start out by you giving a brief introduction of yourself?
Thanks, Vicki. And I don't expect to agree with everybody on anything. You know, it just never works out that way.
It never does, does it?
And we never get mad at each other. The end result is our primary concern is safety for vulnerable populations. But my background for somebody who doesn't know, I did investigations from 1990 until my retirement to 2021 of vulnerable populations throughout the state of Illinois. And I retired and had more years left in me, but I was just burnt out. And I was tired of seeing literally, not to paraphrase, I'm not plugging the book, but the failure of the state agencies to protect vulnerable populations. So that's what led me to stir a lot of this up. And, you know, I'll argue with anybody. I put safety of vulnerable populations first, which tends to make all sides of the fence angry at me. And that's okay.
Yeah. And your book has been out relatively, I mean, it has been relatively recent that you published that. It's been out since, what, a year maybe?
Yeah, about a year, something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and it is available on Amazon called Failure to Protect. It's still available. And personally, I can't say I enjoyed reading it, but it was certainly very informative. And I think that people who are concerned about the plight of people with significant disabilities in this state need to read. So there's your plug for the day.
And I'm going to clarify, you probably didn't enjoy it because it's a very sad subject to even read. It's,
yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah, it wasn't because the book was written badly.
Okay.
Just to clarify that, very well written, very clear. So, yeah, so you read about the closure and you know that the state is planning on moving roughly half the people from Shoat Developmental right. Center, which has been it's been like the eye of the hurricane when it comes to abuses and crimes against people with disabilities. Is that going to fix anything?
No.
Okay, no, show's over. Thanks very much, Barry.
Well, I want to make sure that was clear. Let it resonate.
Yeah, yeah.
Because these problems are systemic at every DD facility and many private, you know, SILA locations. Is when you have a situation set up, especially when you have individuals that are so vulnerable that, you know, they can't speak or nobody believes them, even if they can speak, moving them from one place to the other without adequate protections isn't doing anything except maybe if the state's goal is to close the facilities.
But, you know, but that apparently is not the case. They are not wanting to close it.
Yeah, truth will tell on that in time, I think. I mean, they could transition. There's needs for, you know, forensic nursing homes, forensic locations for children, you know, the temporary holding locations for meth issues. Yeah, they could transition into something else. But that's not for me to address. My concern is the DD population. And, you know, the problem I have is when the state police, the inspector general, who is tasked and assigned primary responsibility to protect these individuals, and prosecutors all say these locations for DD vulnerable populations need to have CCTV cameras for their protection. And nobody listens to those individuals and those agencies, so I don't understand why they don't listen to them. And, you know, I'm not saying somebody who has their own apartment needs to have a camera in it, but if you have paid people that come in who are more times than not lowly trained, lowly paid, and you can't, you know, the individuals they're caring for can't say what they're doing wrong to them,
mm-hmm.
why would you put, that's like putting, in some situations, that's like putting an infant to let strangers care for your infant in a home and just say, well, I hope they take care of that.
Yeah. And I know a number of parents who have had their adult children or maybe even currently have children who are living in facilities like this, who, as you say, their adult child is not able to talk. They don't have a phone. They don't have any way of expressing to anyone that they're being abused or mistreated in any way. And so how can, I don't understand, here's what I don't understand, why the parents of the folks at Shoat don't go to the administrators in arms and say, look, you need to put in closed circuit television cameras. Why don't they do it at Murray? Why don't they do it at Shapiro? There are parent groups that they care about their children. Why isn't this happening?
Well, I had one of the parents tell me because they said, well, we're scared that the public will be, everybody will be able to see that video. That's misinformation. That's treated highly confidential by only a couple of authority people who have access to that video. And then they also just matter-of-factly said Well, the video could be used to shut the facility down.
Okay.
Well, which would you rather have? Stop the abuse or let it continue just so the facility will stay open?
Yeah, I mean, it's nuts.
I don't understand that response at all.
I don't either. And I'm really concerned that in this article that Beth Hunsdorfer wrote recently, that they are moving, you know, half the population of SHOAT to the Murray Center in, where is it, Centralia, Illinois. Mm-hmm. So a little bit north.
Yeah.
But they're not laying anybody off. So are they moving people from SHOAT, those staff members who have been working with these folks all along?
Well, most likely they aren't moving them, but staff will have that opportunity because Murray, they're recruiting heavily now. And those employees at SHOAT will have bidding rights to have first choice to have those jobs. So some SHOAT staff have already transferred to other state facilities. I know that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and that's, you know, neither here, I guess, you know, Murray's had its problems. Murray needs cameras. Murray had what the state police and OIG and the prosecutor thought was literally, they didn't charge it as a murder, but they charged it as a aggravated neglect because an individual died as a result of the intentional neglect by an employee. But guess what? The person was acquitted. The trial, they were found not guilty because they didn't have much evidence other than a dead individual and some other evidence. But imagine if they had video of the hallway leading to and from that shower, not in the shower. I'm not advocating for that. I don't advocate for cameras in showers or bedrooms. They just need to be in the common rooms. And the public just has to trust me. And I wish the Inspector General's office could be more vocal to the public. Is you guys haven't seen the frequency of these terrible things that occur at both state facilities and SILAs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason I can do it publicly now because I'm retired. But trust me, 99.9% of OIG staff and state police staff are just, they agree 100% with what I'm saying
mm-hmm.
about these cameras. And I just, without those, we're just going to have the same stuff occur in different location that will get caught sooner or later.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
When they started this, I said, don't focus this on SHOAT. This isn't just SHOAT. This is every DD facility. This is many SILAs that don't have cameras yet. Unless you have guaranteed one good employee on every shift, on every unit, that will stop abuse or report it, then you need cameras.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
And I think that the state is fighting that because it's just going to cause a big uproar, and then they're going to be having to consider closing all of these facilities down, which is something that they should do eventually. But I agree with you in that closed circuit TV cameras, at least as something to keep people safe during this transition time.
Yes, it's because without. There's data that supports it, and I'm not going to bore you with data and everything, but the last I checked, you know, SILA abuse and neglect is triple the abuse and neglect substantiated than state facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? I don't know. I think it has something to do with maybe staff tell on each other more at a private agency than they do at state facilities. May or may not be that. But the point is, there are SILAs that me and many other people are familiar with, I wouldn't think of letting anybody stay there that are still licensed and funded and have individuals there.
Wow. Is this reported anywhere? Is this just a deep, dark secret of the system?
It's kind of a deep, dark secret because they don't reveal case synopsis on every case to the public. And if they did, it would only be the substantiated ones. A lot of times they have recommendations that disclose a lot of bad things going on that I can't express enough the frustration level with OIG investigators, why they have cases that they, you know, the evidence looks like it's there, but they can't prove it because of this or that.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that if they had cameras, it would 100% prove it or disprove it.
So they tell the families that if there are cameras, then somehow this video is going to get to the internet and be available for anybody to look at. And that's just not the case.
No, that's totally false. I mean, here's the thing. A lot of these parents, you know, they do great on these associations and commissions and stuff. But they also know, it's the old thing like in school. Is the school board member's kid going to get treated different than the kid who their parent isn't on the school board? I don't think, you know, it's very frequent that somebody who is very active and involved is their, you know, their loved one is going to be a target.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And there's also the opposite possibility is true, that if a parent is advocating and, you know, complaining about the services that their child is receiving in those places, they could be further isolated from their family member.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you this before the show. It's nothing big, but I've had multiple parents contact me on different emails and sites wanting to know if I would go in and check on their loved one periodically because they don't live near them or mm-hmm. they don't know what to look for. And I hadn't really thought about it, but I'm researching the, you know, legalities and whatever on that, because, you know, that may be something I do in the future too, just be a, you know, a freelance monitor for people to help them out.
Yeah, I have a friend who had a son living in the Shapiro Center up there in Kankakee, and she, even though she lived in the Champaign-Urbana area, she would drive up there a couple times a week at minimum to check on mm-hmm. her son because she just could not trust that he was going to be well cared for.
Right. And part of this transition plan, you said we were going to discuss that, you know, they hired a new positions, which is the overall operations, like a safety director over all the facilities, which, you know, that's great. It depends on what they do though, because they shouldn't have any authority over OIG and it shouldn't be any type of way to screen things from OIG. They should be a liaison. If OIG has a problem with a facility, maybe they could be the liaison between OIG or something, but OIG is tasked with the safety. They need more authority, and right now they literally have hardly any.
Not only more authority, but more money to provide the services that they need, so they can hire more people and train people to do the investigations that are necessary, and obviously they're quite necessary.
Right, right. And, you know, like I said, the data, I could pull that data up for you sometime and show you, but the frequency of staff reporting staff at state facilities is so rare that it's probably even less than 1% of all the allegations made in the state.
So how do these reports come about?
You'll have the individuals who are verbal. They'll make the allegations, and then it makes it to security, who then hopefully reports it. But that, and it's supported because you take your nonverbal facilities. I hate to stereotype that way, but that's, for better terms, that's what I'll call it. Mm-hmm. Like Murray historically had the lowest number of allegations when I was with the Inspector General's office because a majority of the individuals were nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
So who's going to report it other than the nursing staff, the social workers, or the direct care staff?
Yeah.
And it rarely happens.
Or the hospital, possibly. If somebody has to be taken to the hospital for care, they might report it as well. But the thing that worries me, and I mean, there are a lot of things that worry me when it comes to this situation, but that there are, the reports are for physical abuse and, or injury. And there is probably much more going on in the way of verbal abuse of people. Can you imagine having to live in a condition where you're being abused in one way or the other all the time because people have little or no respect for you as a human being?
Well, yeah, and that's part of it. And then let's throw in the person who is a sadistic, abusive person or a sexual predator. A sexual predator would have a field day at any cella, except for the ones with cameras, and any state facilities. Who's gonna express unless they get caught in the act by somebody who will report it?
Yeah. Long story short, I don't think that just moving people around, you know, playing a little shell game with people's lives is something that's going to be effective.
Exactly. That's not going to be effective. And then they're throwing out there, they're going to pass legislation for CCTV implementation with the caveat that it's only at cillas and it has to be 100% agreement of all of the individuals or their guardians who live there, which means what?
I hadn't heard that. Is that recent information?
Yeah, recent. Yeah, it was posted on somebody's site about one of the state reps near the Murray area was going to propose something like that. But the 100% part, that's like saying you got 99 individuals' families want it, and one doesn't, so they're not going to get it.
Yeah. And who's to know who, whether or not that actually happens, because the administrators of those facilities are not going to publicize the names of people who have agreed or not agreed to that.
Right.
That's private information.
Yeah. If they're going to do it that way, I'd advocate that they should have some units for individuals who want cameras and some units that are not CCTV if they don't want it.
Yeah.
You don't make everybody 100% agreement, because in today's society, can you get anybody in a group to agree 100%?
Not in my world.
Mine either. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously there's a lot that needs to be done yet. And I agree with, you know, the safety of the people who are there should be key while this transition is going on. But I think the state needs to develop a real plan where people's needs are being accounted for, and that people are going to be, you know, they say, well, some people will go into community settings. Well, we don't know what that means. We don't know where they will be. And we don't know what services will be provided to them, if any.
And we don't know what quality of the public setting is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't understand. I got a message the other day from, you know, it's ARC saying they don't support CCTV. That's just a blanket statement. Why? Discuss it. Have a group. Meet with state police. Meet with the inspector general.
Yeah, I don't get that, but I know people at the ARC, so I'm going to ask that question at a meeting tomorrow that we're going to have and discuss, you know, why that is and what the objection might be, because people are getting hurt. People are dying, and we have no control over that at the moment. We just have to trust that the people that are taking care of them are doing the right thing, and that's not the case.
Yes, and I agree with the privacy aspect of it, but nowadays with the technology, at the facilities I've dealt with that have cameras, or the state facility, the mental health side that has cameras, it was never a problem saying that the individuals who reside there, that it bothered them. So I'm more than willing to meet with anybody, and I can give, if they want to hear horror stories of cases and horror stories of cases that I've completed or that OIG's completed, that if it weren't for cameras, they would never have been solved. I'm more than happy to do that, but I usually don't like to try to use shock therapy. But I'm thinking it's come to the point where somebody needs to hear what's really going on in all of these state DD facilities and all of these, or most of these private facilities. Because there's a facility that state DD facility that, you know, I'm not going to say who or what group, but many have the opinion that is far worse than shows.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised at all. And I think the one good thing that your book has done, and that the articles written by Molly and Beth have done, is that it's bringing this to light to people in the general public. People are starting.
I'm sorry. I don't leave out yourself, and don't leave out Ed McManus, because you both do a great job.
Yeah. Oh, definitely Ed McManus. He has been a real hero in this work too. So yeah, thanks to all of you for what you have done, and keep it up. It's so, so important for the families, and especially for their family members who are stuck in these places without any supports.
Yes. Yeah. I think right now what we're seeing is just, for better terms, a smoke screen, or, you know, squirting a garden hose on a forest fire. You know, it wouldn't make me sleep easier at night if I had a loved one in a state DD facility or a SILA.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. Thank you so much for joining me today. Barry Smoot, author of Failure to Protect. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week.
Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey,
you are listening.